Have you heard yourself? You know, I feel sorry for you. You made some sort of life for yourself. You had a career, and yet you're willing to throw it all away for what? To settle old scores? Search for answers where there aren't any? Just let it go. Leave now before you make things even worse for yourself. I reach for my drink and take a long, slow sip. I saw you. You were there. I didn't hurt Chris. I tried to save him.
Right.
I tried to talk him down, but he was beyond reason, rambling, insane stuff. And then he jumped. And I ran. I admit it. I didn't want to stick around, have people leap to the wrong conclusions.
I wonder if his choice of words, leap to, is deliberately callous. But I don't think so. And I don't think he's lying. Deep down, I'm not sure I ever believed he pushed Chris. I wanted to. He gave me another reason to hate him. And maybe he gave me a get-out, too. Because if Chris jumped, it meant I'd let him down. Just like Annie. Of course, I don't believe Hurst tried to save Chris, either. The only person Hurst has ever cared about saving is himself. That's what I'm counting on.
Why are you so afraid of me being here?
I'm not. Just sick of it.
Yeah, funnily enough, you don't look so well.
I'm tired. Cancer takes its toll on everyone. There. Happy? Not such a perfect life after all. Is that what you want to hear?
I stare at him. Maybe he's right. Maybe things haven't worked out so well for him. I think about what Miss Grayson said.
He is desperate. You are the only person who can stop him.
I fully intend to. But that's not why I'm here. First, I have other business. Business Hurst would understand. Saving my own skin business.
I take the bag and thump it onto the desk. I see his eyes widen.
He recognizes the battered, unbranded holdall, the faded and curling Doctor Who and Star Trek stickers.
What the hell is this?
I think you know. But for the members of the jury, I open it and carefully place the contents in front of him. It's the crowbar you smashed my sister's head in with, and your school tie, coated in her blood, and your DNA.
His mouth works, teeth grinding. Chewing on this information like a bitter pill.
And what is this supposed to prove? Your sister was found. Alive.
We both know that's not what happened.
Try telling that story to the police. I'm sure they'll find you a nice comfy straitjacket to slip into.
Fine. Try this. My sister disappeared for 2 days, 48 hours. Where was she? What do you think the police would do if they were given this evidence? Evidence that you took her? Hurt her? How would that go down with the villagers, your councillor bodies?
He stares at the plastic bag containing the crowbar and the bloody tie for a long time. Then he raises his eyes.
So I'll ask you again. What do you want?
$30,000. I wait. And then something happens to his face. I was expecting anger, denial, maybe threats. Instead, he leans back in his chair, and a sound bellows from his lips. Laughter. In all the scenarios I played out in my mind, this is not the one I expected. I glance nervously towards the window. Just darkness outside. I feel my tension rise.
Want to share the joke?
He straightens and gathers himself.
It's you. It's always been you. Fine.
I pick up the crowbar and the tie and put them back inside the bag. Maybe I'll just take this to the police right now. No, you won't.
You sound very sure about that.
I am.
If you try to stop me, or plan on calling your thugs, I should warn you that...
Stop talking shit.
He cuts me down.
I have no intention of hurting you. You see, that's your problem. You're always looking for someone to strike out at, someone to blame. You never stop to think that you brought all of this on yourself.
I don't know what the hell you mean.
I know about the crash.
What's to know? It was an accident. My sister and father died.
Where were you going that night?
I don't remember.
Convenient.
The truth.
The papers speculated that something must have happened, that your father was driving to hospital. Not long before the crash, someone tried to call 999 from your house.
I wonder how he knows this.
Or perhaps more importantly, why he has made it his business to know.
Why don't you just get to the point?
Your father didn't crash your car that night by accident.
You're wrong. There was evidence he tried to brake, tried to prevent the crash.
Oh, I'm not saying it wasn't an accident. But your father didn't cause it.
He smiles, and I feel my house of cards, my so close to winning hand, fold and flutter to the ground.
You did, Joe. You were the one driving.
34. The past isn't real. It's simply a story we tell ourselves. And sometimes, we lie. I loved my little sister, so much. But the sister I loved was gone. I saw her walking around the house in the strange lurching way she had now, like her body was the wrong fit. But I didn't see Annie. I saw something that looked like Annie, sounded like Annie, but it was a fake, a bad copy. Sometimes I wanted to scream at my parents.
Can't you see? It's not Annie. Something happened and she's gone. There was a mistake, a terrible mistake, and this thing got sent back in her place. A thing that is wearing her skin and looking through her eyes, but when you look back, it's not Annie inside.
But I didn't, because that would have sounded crazy. And I knew it was the last thing my parents needed to deal with. I didn't want to be the straw that finally broke our family into pieces. I needed to sort this out, to put it right. So one day, before school, I picked up the phone in a trembling hand and called the doctors. I put on my best voice and said I was Mr. Thorne and wanted to make an appointment for my daughter. The receptionist, who was brisk and efficient, but obviously not very perceptive, barked that she could fit us in at 4:30 that afternoon. I thanked her and said that was perfect. When I got back from school, I told Dad I had just remembered that Mum said she'd made an appointment for Annie at the doctor's. Fortunately, he was only on his second can. He complained, but I said that was okay. He could tell Mum that he had decided to cancel it. That did the trick. Dad didn't want to risk going against Mum, making her mad. He stuck his jacket on and yelled for Annie to come downstairs. I said I'd go along too. On the way, I bought some mints from the shop. I offered Dad one. He took two. The doctor was an overweight man with a nose full of red veins and a thin scraping of dry hair over his shiny head. He was friendly enough, but he looked tired, and I noticed that the case by his feet was already packed, ready to go home. He examined Annie, shone things into her eyes,
tapped her knee. Annie sat in the chair, as stiff as a ventriloquist's dummy. After performing his tests, the doctor patiently explained that he couldn't find anything physically wrong with Annie. However, she had suffered a trauma. Missing for 2 days, lost, maybe trapped somewhere, who knew what had happened to her? The bedwetting, the nightmares, the strange behaviour were all to be expected. We just had to be patient. Give her time. If there was no improvement, he could refer us to a therapist. He smiled. It probably wouldn't come to that. Annie was young. The young are incredibly resilient. She would be back to her old self in no time, he was sure. Dad thanked him and shook his hand. His own hand was shaking quite a bit. I was glad I had bought the mints. We walked home again. Annie wet herself on the way. Trauma. Give her time. He was sure. I wasn't. I thought it was a load of bullshit. And for some reason, I felt that we were running out of time. On top of this, I was dealing with Chris's death. Or rather, I wasn't. There had been a funeral at the crematorium. It didn't feel real. I kept expecting to turn around and find Chris standing beside me, blonde hair sticking up like always, pointing out that the temperature of the furnace was between 1400 and 1800 degrees Fahrenheit. The body was consumed in 2.5 hours, and the crematorium burnt around 50 bodies a week. Chris's mum sat at the front. He didn't have any other family. His dad had left when he was little, and his older brother had died of cancer before Chris was born. His mum had the same wild white hair as Chris. She wore a shapeless black dress and clutched a pile of tissues. But she didn't cry. She just kept staring straight ahead. Occasionally she mumbled something and smiled. Somehow, it was more awful than if she'd been bawling her eyes out. I saw her a few times afterwards. She was still wearing the same clothes. I felt like I should say something, but I didn't know what. Whenever I walked by Chris's house, the curtains were pulled. A couple of weeks later, a for sale board went up. I found myself wandering the village aimlessly after school, always ending up beneath the block, staring up, wondering how it felt to fall so far, so fast. People left flowers and tributes. There was even one from Hurst. The temptation to take it, rip it to shreds and stamp it into the ground was almost too much. I never did. Just like I never told anyone how I saw him that day. Chris's death had put me in a kind of paralysis. I had hidden the bag in the shed, but I didn't know what I was supposed to do with it. I couldn't think. Couldn't seem to get my head in order. Every time I thought about the bag, I saw Chris lying on the ground, his oddly deflated body, the thick dark blood. So much blood. And then I would think of my sister. Sometimes, I wondered if I was the one going crazy. Maybe there was nothing wrong with Annie. Maybe the knock I'd taken to the head had done something to my brain. Maybe I was imagining it all. I was finding it hard to concentrate in school, remembering to eat, to have a bath. Those things didn't seem important anymore. My long, repetitive treks around the village became longer and longer. One night, a police officer stopped me and told me to go home. It was almost midnight. I woke several times a night, clawing at the air to escape the nightmares. In one, Chris and Annie stood on a snowy hill. The sky shimmered behind them, a dappled candy pink. The sun was black, haloed by a silvery light, like an eclipse. Chris and Annie looked perfect again, whole, like they did before they died. All around them, there were snowmen. Big, round, fluffy white snowmen with long, twiggy arms and lumps of shiny black coal for their eyes and mouths. As I watched, their crooked smiles twisted into snarls.
"You can't stay here. There's nobody here but us snowmen. Go back. Go back."
The sun plummeted below the horizon. Chris and Annie disappeared. The candy pink sky bubbled and boiled, darkening to a deep crimson. Flakes started to fall. But not white. Red. And not flakes. Blood. Huge fat drops of blood that burnt like acid. I fell to the ground. My skin was melting from my bones. My bones were melting into the ground. The snowmen watched with cold black eyes as I dissolved into nothing. The next morning, I knew what I had to do. I got dressed in my school uniform, like usual. I left at the normal time, but my bag contained a few other items packed carefully under my textbooks. I walked briskly out of the house. I didn't head down the street towards the school. I headed up towards the old pit. They had fixed the broken fence, put even more warning signs up. "Danger. Keep out. Trespassers will be prosecuted." There was supposed to be a man from the council who patrolled the site to make sure no other kids got in there, but I didn't see anyone this morning as I walked slowly along the perimeter. It didn't look so secure. The fence was still a bit wobbly, and there were gaps between the mesh panels. It didn't take long for me to find one that was just about big enough for me to squeeze through, although it was a squeeze. My school blazer caught on a sharp bit of wire and snagged. I tugged it free and felt it rip. I cursed. Mum would tear a strip off me for that. Or she would have done before. Now, I realized, she probably wouldn't even notice. I trudged on, up the hill. It looked different this morning. It was cold, but the sun was shining. It didn't exactly brighten the place, but it did somehow soften its sharper, bleaker edges. It also threw me a bit. Which way was the hatch? At the bottom of the next steep rise, or was it the one after that? I stood and looked around, but the more I looked, the more uncertain I felt. Panic began to nibble at the edges of my stomach. I needed to be quick. I couldn't be too late for school. I started one way, then changed my mind and doubled back the other. Everything looked the same. Shit. What would Chris do? How did he find it? And then I remembered. He didn't find it. It found him. I stood and breathed slowly. I didn't try to think or look. I just let myself be. And then I walked. To my left, up one rise, down, and then up another, steeper hill. I scrabbled down the rocky slope. At the bottom was a small hollow, shielded by scrubby bushes. "Here," I thought. I couldn't see it. All I could see was rubble and rocks, but I knew it was here. I could almost feel the ground humming beneath my feet. I approached cautiously, trying to train my eyes not to scan the ground, not to look too carefully. And it worked. Suddenly I made out the shape of the hatch in the earth. I crouched down. Up close it wasn't quite closed. There was enough of a gap for me to wedge my fingers underneath and move it. I tried, and, satisfied I could do it, I lowered it down again. I didn't plan on going down there right now. I couldn't turn up to school covered in dirt and coal dust. Plus, I couldn't risk someone spotting something and coming up here to investigate. I had to come back later, when it was darker. when I could do what I needed to, without anyone stopping me. For now, I took the items I had carefully packed in my bag and hid them beneath a scrubby bit of bush. Then, because I didn't want to run the risk of not finding the hatch again when I came back later, I draped an old red sock I had brought with me around one of the branches. It would do. The first part of my plan finished, I stood and made my way back out of the site and down to school. The day dragged, yet it also went too fast, in the way it always does when you're waiting for something, yet also dreading it, like a trip to the dentist's or the doctor's. I'd happily have traded a pulled tooth for what I had to do this evening. Finally, the bell rang, and I walked out of class, worried someone might call my name or stop me, half hoping they would. No one did. I didn't hurry, though. I still had time to kill before the day started to fade to dusk. I did my usual walk around the high street. I had some cash on me that I had nicked out of Dad's wallet the night before, so I bought some chips, even though I wasn't hungry, and picked at them in the bus shelter before chucking half the tray in the bin. I wandered around a bit more, then sat on a swing in the deserted playground for a while. When the streetlights started to blink on, like startled orange eyes, I began my walk up towards the pit. I'd packed a torch in my bag, as well as an old woolen hat of Dad's that I pulled right down over my head, almost over my eyes. I checked out the site for any signs of security, but the street was empty and silent. I slipped through the fence before that could change. I didn't need the torch just yet, even though, now it was almost the end of October, the light was fading fast. I didn't want to draw any attention to myself. Also, for some reason, I felt that I would find my way better in the dark. Despite a couple of trips and stumbles, putting a tear in my school trousers this time, I was right. I reached the bottom of the steep incline and could just make out the red sock, a darker shadow on the bush. I'd made it. And now I was here again. I was crapping myself. I knew I needed to be fast, or else I'd chicken out entirely. I heaved aside the hatch, scraping the skin from my knuckles. Then I retrieved the fireworks that I had hidden beneath the bush, stuffed them back in my bag, and took out my torch. After a final glance around, I lowered myself into the hatch and climbed down the steps. It didn't take long. Once I'd lit the fuses on the fireworks, I barely had time to scramble back up the steps and shove the hatch across the opening before I heard the first muffled bangs. I grabbed my bag and got to my feet. The metal hatch rose before clanging back down again, dust puffing out around it. And then it just kind of collapsed into the ground. I backed away. I'd only taken a few steps before I felt the earth shudder, a rumbling roar that seemed to rise all the way up from the soles of my trainers to my chest. I knew that sound. There had been a rockfall down the pit when I was about Annie's age. No one was hurt, but I always remembered that rumbling roar as somewhere deep below the ground. The earth folded in on itself. It was done, I thought. I just had to hope it was enough. It was almost 8 when I got back home, tired, dirty, but oddly exhilarated. Just for a split second, before I pushed open the back door, I was possessed by this insane notion that suddenly everything would be okay. I had broken the spell, slain the dragon, exorcised the demon. Annie would be herself again. Mum would be cooking tea and Dad would be reading the paper, singing along to the radio like he used to sometimes when he was in a good mood. All crap, of course. When I walked in, Dad was slumped in his usual position in front of the television. I could just see the top of his curly head above the armchair, and I was sure he had already passed out. Annie wasn't downstairs, so I guess she must be in her room again. The smell in the house was worse than ever. I covered my mouth and rushed upstairs to the bathroom. On the landing, I paused. The door to Annie's room was wide open. That never happened anymore. I walked forward. Annie? I peered inside. The room was in semi-darkness, as always. Just the thinnest haze of twilight seeping through the thin curtains. The bed was unmade. If the smell downstairs was bad, up here it was almost unbearable. Stale urine, sweet rot, and something like bad eggs and vomit, all mixed up at once. The room was empty. I checked my bedroom. Also empty. I knocked on the bathroom door. Annie? Are you in there? Silence. There was no lock on the bathroom door. Dad had taken it off when Annie was little, after she locked herself inside one day. Mum and I had sat outside and sung to her to keep her calm. All the while, Dad had worked on the lock to get it off the door. When we finally burst in, Annie had gone to sleep, curled up in just a nappy and a t-shirt on the bathroom floor. I stared at the closed door. Then I grasped the handle, which felt oddly sticky, pushed it open, and pulled on the light. My world swam. Red. So much red everywhere. All over the sink, smeared across the mirror, splodges trailing over the floor, rich, glistening, fresh. I stared, my guts heaving. I looked at my hand. The palm was stained crimson. I turned and half ran, half stumbled back down the stairs. I noticed now that the walls and banister were covered in more red smudges. Annie? Dad? I jumped the last step and into the living room. Dad was still slumped in the armchair, his back to me. Dad? I edged around the armchair. His face drew into view, eyes half closed, mouth half open, a small, rattling wheeze of breath coming from his lips. He wore an old wet, wet, wet sweatshirt. He'd won it in some local radio competition. He'd wanted to win the holiday to Spain. Weird, the things you notice. Like I noticed that below Marty Pello's face, a huge stain had spread out from the center of my dad's chest. Like an ink stain. Like when I left the lid off my fountain pen. Except it was too big. And it wasn't blue. It was red. Dark red. Not ink. Blood. Wet, wet, wet. I tried to fight down the panic. Tried to think. Stabbed. He had been stabbed. And he was missing. I needed to call the police. I needed to call 999. I ran over to the phone on the wall and picked up the receiver. I dialed with trembling fingers. It rang and rang, and then a pleasant voice said, "Which service do you require?" I opened my mouth, but the words dried up. Blood. Red. Fresh. "Hello? Which service do you require?" The bathroom. Splodges on the floor. But not splodges. Shapes. One splodge. Five small ones. Footprints. Small footprints.
"Hello? Are you still there?"
I lowered the phone. From behind me, I heard a noise. A tiny giggle. I put the receiver back
and turned around. Annie stood in the doorway. She must have been crouched in the cupboard beneath the stairs. She was naked. Blood streaked her body and her face like war paint. I could see gashes on her arms, a narrow chest. She had slashed at herself too. Her eyes glittered. In one hand, she held a large kitchen knife. I tried to breathe, tried not to throw myself screaming out of a window. A knife. Dad. Wet, wet, wet. Annie? Are you all right? I thought someone broke in. I saw confusion flicker. It's okay. I'm home now. I'll protect you. You know that, don't you? I'm your big brother. I'll always protect you. The knife wavered. Something in her face changed. She almost looked like my Annie, like she used to. I felt my heart clench. Put the knife down. We can sort this out. I held out my arms, tears thickening my voice. Come on. She smiled and charged at me with a growl of guttural ferocity. I was ready. I sidestepped and shoved her hard. She flew forward, tripped on the hearthrug and fell. I grabbed for the poker by the fire, but there was no need. Her head caught the corner of the fireplace. She crumpled to the floor, the knife falling from her hand. I stood, shaking, half expecting her to leap straight back up. She continued to lie still, because whatever was inside, it was still inside the body of an 8-year-old girl. And 8-year-olds are fragile. They break easily. I looked back at my dad. I had to get him to a hospital. I glanced at the phone, then I ran into the kitchen. A while ago, Dad had given me a few driving lessons, just up and down the local roads. Back then, in Arnhill, no one really gave a shit about a 15-year-old behind the wheel. I wasn't great, but I knew the basics. And I knew where Dad's keys were. Dad was heavy. He had put on weight. I dragged him to the door, inched it open and glanced out at the street. No one about. Curtains drawn. I couldn't be sure that some busybody like Mrs. Hawkins wasn't peering out of her net curtains, but I had to take the chance. I heaved his body down the short pathway and over to the car. I propped him against the back door and opened the passenger side. Then I manhandled him in, body first, and then his legs and feet. I stood back. My hands and the front of my school shirt were covered with blood. No time to worry about that. The hospital was 12 miles away, in Nottingham. I had to move quicker. I hurried around to the driver's side and stopped. I looked back at the house. Annie. I couldn't just leave her. She stabbed your dad. She's still just a kid. Not anymore. She might die. And? I can't leave her. Not again. Not like before. I ran back into the house. Half of me expected to find Annie had gone, like in horror films, when you think the hero has killed the bad guy only for them to disappear and then reappear later, wielding a chainsaw. But Annie still lay where she had fallen. Naked. Shit. I ran back upstairs, heart thudding like an internal clock, reminding me that time was running out. I flung open the small white wardrobe in Annie's room, grabbed some pajamas, pink with white sheep, and ran back down the stairs. She didn't stir as I dragged them on her, although I could feel her breathing faintly. I lifted her in my arms, as slight as a baby deer. She felt cold, and a part of me couldn't contain a shudder of distaste. I was almost at the gate when I saw a shadow approaching along the street and heard excited panting. A dog walker. I backed up and waited in the shadows as they passed. The dog stopped near the gate, sniffed, then recoiled, tugging its owner faster down the road.
All right, got scent of a fox, have you?
No, I thought, but it got a scent of something. I bundled Annie into the back of the car. Then I ran around to the front and flung myself into the driver's seat. My hands were shaking so badly it took me 3 attempts to fumble the keys into the ignition. Fortunately, miraculously, the engine started first time. I put the car into gear. Suddenly remembered my seatbelt. I clicked it in and lurched off down the street. I concentrated on trying to stay on the right side of the road, and also on not bumping the curb. It distracted me from thinking about what I would do if Dad died on the way, or what I would say if he didn't. I needed a story. I remembered what I'd said to Annie. An intruder. Someone broke in. They would believe that. They had to. And if Dad was alive, he could tell the truth. I was out of the village now. The black country road twisted in front of me like an oily snake. No street lights, only cat's eyes. I couldn't find the full beam. A car emerged from a side road and pulled close behind me. Too close. The glare in the rearview mirror was blinding me. What if it was the police? What if they had traced the 999 call and they were following me? And then the car signaled and pulled past, horn blaring. I glanced down at the speedo. I was only doing 35 miles per hour on a 60 miles per hour road. No wonder they were pissed off at me. And I was drawing attention to myself. Despite the blackness and my tenuous grip on the wheel, I forced myself to push my foot down harder on the accelerator. I watched the needle creep up to 40, 50. I glanced in the rearview mirror again. Annie stared back at me. I swerved. The tires bumped the verge. I wrestled with the steering wheel to drag it back again. The rubber squealed, but managed to regain its grip on the tarmac. Dad fell heavily against me. Crap, I'd forgotten to do up his seatbelt. I shoved him back into his seat with one hand, trying to control the steering wheel with the other. Annie lunged from the back seat. Her fingers clawed at my face and grabbed my hair, yanking my head back. I tried to bat at her with my free hand, but her grip was surprisingly strong. I felt her nails rake my flesh. The roots of my hair screamed. I bunched my hand into a fist and struck her hard in the face. She fell back. I grabbed the wheel again, just in time, as headlights flashed by on the opposite side of the road. Fuck. I pressed my foot down harder still on the accelerator. I had to get to the hospital. Had to. The speed crept up to 70. I saw Annie pull herself up to a sitting position. I tried to strike back with my elbow, but she ducked past and wrapped her hands around my eyes. Her fingers dug in. I yelled. I couldn't see. My eyes were streaming, just glimmers of darkness and light. I let go of the wheel with one hand, tried to pull her fingers away. My foot slipped on the accelerator. The engine screamed. I felt the car spin, the wheels leave the tarmac and hit the grassy bank. The car bucked. Annie's fingers let go. A huge black shadow loomed ahead. A tree. I tried to grab the wheel back, stamped on the brake. Too late. Impact. A monstrous jolt. Crunching metal. My body flew forward,
nose smashing against the steering wheel. The seatbelt flung me back again, dazed. Something crashed past me out of the windscreen. Pain. My chest. My face. My leg. My leg! Screaming. My own.
Blackness. 35.
That was how we found you.
We?
Me and Dad. We were coming back from the footy, evening match. Dad spotted the car, all smashed up against a tree. We pulled over to see if we could help. Saw straight away that your dad was dead. I found your sister's body a little way from the car. I couldn't help her. He pauses. I went back to the car, and Dad said, "The boy's still alive." Then he said, "And he's got a big problem, hasn't he?" I knew what he meant right away. You were only 15. You shouldn't have been driving. We decided to move you, put you in the passenger seat and your dad in the driver's, so the police would think he was driving.
Why? Why did you care?
Because, whatever differences we had, Dad believed you looked after your own. You were part of my gang. Your dad was a miner, even if he was a scab. You didn't dob your own in to the pigs. I was supposed to come and see you in hospital, tell you to stick to the story, but turned out you'd already got one of your own. Couldn't remember anything about the crash, a nurse told me. That true, Joe?
I stare at him. Lies, I think. There are no such things as white lies. Lies are never black or white, only grey. A fog obscuring the truth. Sometimes so thick we can barely see it ourselves. To start with, I wasn't sure what I remembered. It was easier to just go along with what the police and the doctors told me. Easier to close my eyes and say I didn't know what had happened. Couldn't remember the crash. I never told Mum. But then, she never asked about any of it. She must have had questions. She must have cleaned up the blood. But she never said a word. And once, when I tried to talk to her, she gripped my wrist so hard it left bruises and said, "Whatever happened in that house, it was an accident, Joe. Just like the crash. Do you understand? I have to believe that. I can't lose you too." That was when I understood. She thought I had done this. That I was somehow responsible. I suppose I couldn't blame her. I had been acting weird for weeks. Hardly eating, not talking, staying out as much as possible. And in a way, I was responsible. I had caused it. All of it. When I returned home on crutches, pins in my shattered leg, the house had been aired and cleaned, and Annie's room had been freshly decorated. Everything was the same as it was before. I didn't try to put Mum right, or tell her what had really happened, and she never put into words what I saw in her eyes. That the wrong child had been lost. That it should have been me. Until the day she died, Mum pretended she still loved me. And I pretended not to know that she didn't. I clear my throat. My head feels too full, conflicting thoughts wrestling with each other in the mud of my consciousness. "You want me to thank you?" I say. Hurst shakes his head. "No. I want you to take these," he gestures at the crowbar and the tie, "and chuck them into the River Trent. And then, I want you to fuck off and never come back." I feel sick.
loser, sick. That feeling when you see the other player's cards and know you have been screwed. That you are done. Well, almost done. The police will ask you questions too. Why you moved me? Why come forward now? Tampering with the scene of an accident? That's a crime. He nods. True. But I was just a kid. It was my dad's idea. Now I'm older and wiser. It has made me reevaluate things. I need to come clean. If I have to, I can spin this. And they'll believe me. I'm a respected member of the community. While you, well, look at yourself. Suspended from your current job. Suspicion of theft from your old school. You're hardly a model citizen. He's right. And what if they start asking more questions? Investigate the scene again. Question my dad's injuries. So, Hurst says, I think this is what we call a stalemate. I nod and stand. I take the carefully wrapped items and put them back into the holdall. I don't really have any other choice. I take my phone out of my pocket. Hurst stares at it. You're still going to call the police? No. I bring up my contacts and raise the phone to my ear. She answers on the first ring. Hi, Joe. You need to talk to him. I hold out the phone to Hurst. He looks at it like I'm holding out a grenade. And I am, in a way. And who exactly am I talking to? He asks me. The woman who will kill your wife and son if I do not walk out of here 30 grand richer. He takes the phone, and I watch his face turn grey. Gloria can do that to people. Even before she sends him the pictures. Shots of Marie and Jeremy finishing their dinner in town right now. He hands the phone back to me. You'd better get that money, Gloria says. And then, they're leaving. I need to follow them. I end the call and look at Hurst. 30 grand. Transfer it now, and I'll be out of your hair for good. He just stares at me. He looks dazed. Like someone has just told him all at once that the world is flat, aliens exist, and Jesus is on his way back for a visit. Gloria can do that to you too. What the hell have you done? He croaks. I just need the money. His eyes find focus. They are full of tears. I don't have it. I don't believe you. That car sitting out front is worth 60 grand at least. Contract lease. This house, remortgaged. The villa in Portugal. I sold it. Barely broke even. The sick feeling is back. Worse now. It feels like a rat is worrying away at my insides. Chewing through my stomach lining. Heading for my bowels. I don't think Gloria will like to hear that. He runs a hand through his perfectly coiffed hair. It's the truth. I don't have 30 grand. I don't have 20 or 10 or even 5 fucking grand. Bullshit. It's all gone. Marie's treatment in America. Do you know how much a miracle cure costs? A bitter chuckle. Over £750,000, that's how much. It's everything I've got. I've nothing left. Liar! I shake my head. Just like always. Trying to save your skin. You're a liar. It's the truth. No. I called the clinic in America. Marie told me about it. And guess what? They've never heard of you or Marie. She isn't booked in there for a fucking ingrowing toenail, let alone a miracle cancer treatment. I stare at him in triumph. I expect to see the usual defiant snarl. A man challenged and angry at being caught in a lie. But instead I see something else. Something not expected. Confusion. Fear. That can't be right. She paid them. I transferred the money. More lies, do you ever stop? I know what you're planning. I can show you the bank statements, the account number. Right, of course you can. I stop suddenly. I stare at him. She? Marie. She found the clinic. She arranged it all, the hotels, flights. You transferred all the money to Marie? Into our joint account. She made the payment from there. But you didn't talk to the clinic. You didn't check they received the money. I trust my wife. And why would she lie? She's desperate. She doesn't want to die. This treatment was her only chance. And desperate people want to believe in miracles. I try to stay calm, to think. Why have you been obstructing the country park plans? Because it's more profitable to build houses on the land. Even with what's underneath. He sneers. A rock fall sealed that place off years ago. That's what I hoped. But it seems your son has found another way in. Jeremy? No. And what the hell does this have to do with anything? You never told him what we found. I told him never to go up there, to stay away. And kids always do what their parents tell them. Of course they don't. In fact, Jeremy couldn't care less what I say. But he listens to Marie, always has. He'd do anything for her. He's a mummy's boy. I swallow, and it's like swallowing fragments of ground glass. He'd do anything for her. A mummy's boy. And sometimes the apple does not fall so very far from the tree. I've just been barking up the wrong tree. My phone starts to ring. I grab it. Yes. How's it going? I glance at Hurst. Fine. How long till they get back? That's why I called. They're not coming back. What? They drove back from town. Marie dropped the boy off on the high street to meet some mates. Now she's heading along the road to your cottage. My cottage? No, wait, hang on. She's stopped. She's getting out of the car. Okay, this is weird. She's got a torch and a rucksack. Shit. The pit, I say. She's going to the pit. 36. I do not believe in fate. But sometimes there is an ineluctable quality to life, a course it is difficult to alter. It all started here, at the pit. And this, it seems, is where it will end. Not quite how I imagined. Not quite how I planned. But then that's the problem with plans. They never work out like you think. Mine, it seems, never work out at all. We pull up in Hurst's Range Rover. He hasn't said a word throughout the short drive, but I can see the dazed look in his eyes, his jaw clenching and unclenching as he tries to digest what he's learned. Tries to comprehend how Marie could have betrayed him, lied to him. I expect anger, but he just looks broken, diminished. I was wrong about him. I thought Marie was just another trophy, like the house and the car. But Hurst loves her. Always has. And despite everything, he still wants to save her. I spot a yellow Mini parked carelessly by the side of the road. I can't see Gloria or her car. I'm not sure if this is a concern or a relief. We both climb out. Where is she? Hurst asks.
I don't know.
I scan the fence with my torch, find the gap I squeezed through before. Come on. I slip through. Hurst follows. I hear him curse. It isn't just his wallet that is better padded these days.
About time.
I jump. Gloria emerges from the shadows by the fence. Unusually for Gloria, she is wearing a dark coat over her normal pastel hues, dressed for business. I look around. Where's Marie?
In the boot of my car.
You bitch,
Hurst says.
Gloria turns to him.
Stephen Hurst, I presume?
Actually, I'm joking. She set off over that hill about 20 minutes ago.
I quickly intervene. Gloria, Marie has your money. More than 30 grand. Over 750. We just need to bring her down.
She looks at Hurst.
What about him?
What about him?
You said Marie, his wife, has the money.
Yes.
So what use is he?
Gloria,
that's what I thought.
She moves so fast I barely see the gun. I just hear a pop and suddenly Hurst is writhing on the floor, screaming and clutching his leg. Dark red blood is gushing, actually gushing, from the wound. I drop to my knees beside him. I grasp his arms.
Jesus!
I look around. The road beyond the fence is deserted. No one around. Even the headlights of a passing car wouldn't illuminate us here in the shadows.
Femoral artery,
Gloria says, lowering the gun, which has a large silencer attached to the end.
Even if I apply pressure, he will bleed out in approximately 15 to 20 minutes.
Hurst's eyes find mine. Gloria grabs my arm and hauls me up.
You're wasting time. Go and get my fucking money.
But what about...
She presses a finger to my lips.
Tick tock.
I scramble up the hill, torch bobbing wildly up and down in front of me. It isn't a lot of use. I'm guided by gut instinct and fear. I didn't bring my stick, so I stumble limp and scrabble up and down the rocky, slippery slopes. My bad leg provides a near constant accompaniment of pain. My ribs join in on percussion. But another part of me feels disembodied from the whole experience, like I am above myself, and watching as a tall, thin man with a smoker's wheeze and wild black hair staggers around the countryside like a drunken tramp. I want to laugh at the absurdity of it all. Laugh until I scream. The whole thing feels like some terrible, macabre dream. And yet I know, deep down, that this is unremittingly real. A waking nightmare that started 25 years ago and finishes tonight. At the bottom of the hill, I see her. Sitting cross-legged at the entrance. A camping light is beside her, a rucksack at her feet. Her head is swathed in a scarf, and her hood is pulled up against the chill. She hunches over, and for a moment, I think she is praying. Then, as she straightens, I see that she is lighting a cigarette. I flick off the torch and watch her. But I'm not really seeing her. I'm seeing a 15-year-old girl. A girl who was beautiful, clever, and cold. I wonder how I never saw it before. But then a pretty face can blind you to a lot of faults, especially when you were a 15-year-old mass of hormones yourself. You don't care what lies beneath. The darkness, the rotten bones. I take a step forward. Marie? She doesn't turn.
I knew it would be you. Always you. Since we were little kids, a thorn in my side.
By name, by nature.
Go home, Joe.
Okay. If you come with me.
Nice try.
Try this, then.